He hated his assignment. He hated the region. He hated the land. He hated the people. He hated the city. And most of all, he hated it when the big yearly festivals came around. It meant he had to leave his estate in what he considered at least a tolerable part of the region, go into the city, and keep an eye on the people. Which meant he didn't get much sleep, if at all. This past week had been worse than all the previous years combined. There was a man who apparently was causing some kind of commotion, an internal controversy among the people. Rumors were that this man was a hero among many, while to others, this man was a dangerous revolutionary. Yesterday, he had granted a request of the use of some of his men, some of his soldiers, by the local leadership to bring the man in for questioning. Well, right at daybreak, his soldiers, the locals, and the man wanted for questioning had arrived outside his city residence. These local leaders didn't have the courtesy nor the respect to come inside to meet him, because they said that if they did, they'd be defiled and they wouldn't be able to participate in the festival. Whatever, he thought to himself. Even though he'd been there a few years, he still couldn't figure out their strange and what he would consider wacky obsession with petty ritual purification. And so he'd have to go out himself and talk to them. Why did they bring the man to him in the first place? It's probably just some internal religious matter, so why bother him? Why couldn't they take care of it themselves? So he asks them, what's this all about? What has he done? They tell him that the man is a dangerous revolutionary who claims to be the king of the Jews. Well, he thinks to himself, how interesting. If only these people were so kind as to bring to him all of the self-professed revolutionaries, it would save him and his soldiers a whole deal of trouble. It turns out the local leaders want this man executed, and that's why he has to get involved. The fact is, that hardly ever happens. You know, that is, the people turning in one of their own to be executed. So his suspicions are aroused. There must be more to this than what they are telling him. He'll have to question the man himself to see what is really going on. John 18, verse 28. And then they led him from the house of... Actually, let's skip down to verse 33. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord? Or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, What is truth? Pilate just wanted to be rid of the problem. He didn't have the time nor the desire to sit around figuring out or negotiating how to resolve this without causing yet another riot. He was on a short leash. Another riot could mean not only unemployment, but it could mean death. He realized that Jesus was no threat and that the Jewish leaders were fabricating a case against Jesus in order to get rid of him. He, Pilate, thought that if Jesus were to be, say, compared with a truly hardened, dangerous criminal, perhaps the leaders would come to their senses. If they were given a choice between the two, how could they not make the same rational decision? So he went out to the people again, ordering Jesus and Barabbas to be brought out. He motioned for silence and then spoke the offer. He would release one, your choice. Their response stunned him. They wanted Barabbas, son of the Father, released. Not Jesus, the Son of the Father, but Barabbas. Control of the situation was rapidly slipping from Pilate's hands. He must find a way to regain control and get the law back into his hands, but what could he do? That's where chapter 18 ends. This passage from John 18, verses 28 to the end of the chapter, there are several possible things and learnings that we could extract. And among them might be misplaced loyalty to the law, as seen in the Jewish leaders' behavior, or perhaps lack of conviction and strength to stand for what is right, as seen in Pilate. Perhaps we could talk about the nature of God's kingdom and the nature of his rule. We might even go into the inside-outside theme, with and without the light of the world. The leaders were outside. The Pilate was inside with Jesus. We could explore that theme. But as good and interesting as these may be for our exploration, I believe there is something that encompasses all of these and is far more important. Now, I believe John wrote and arranged the account in the manner that he did to emphasize Pilate's question, what is truth? How would you respond to this question, what is truth, if someone were to ask you? What is truth? The Jewish nation of the first century apparently wasn't that different, at least philosophically and religiously, from what we see and experience today in the 21st century of North America and Western Europe. On the one hand, there were the religious fundamentalists, claiming knowledge and possession of absolute truth as revealed in the Law and the Prophets. On the other hand, were the secular fundamentalists, claiming many individualized truths. Does this sound in any way familiar? John writes his account using the Jewish leaders to represent the religious fundamentalists and Pilate representing the secular. Reality, of course, was a little more complicated. There were more gray areas. But for the purposes of explaining what truth is, these stereotypes served John's needs. When the reader of the story encounters Pilate's question, John intends for us, to think back to chapter 14, verse 6, where he writes that Jesus is the truth. Additionally, I think there is some reference back to chapter 5, verses 39 and 40, where John writes, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. And it is they that bear witness about me, yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life." The first part of today's story, where Jesus is brought to Pilate, shows the Jewish leaders being very careful to observe the Mosaic laws and subsequent additions to the original laws on ritual purification. They are shown to be very concerned about proper religious observances of times and of days. Specifically, in the story, it's the Passover. Their belief was that proper observances and remaining clean would lead to acceptance by God. They believed that the laws and the teachings were truth. Yet Jesus himself, in chapter 5, said that these were not truth, but merely tools to lead people to the real truth. The second part of the story involving Pilate. You know, it seems like Pilate is questioning Jesus, but really, it's about Jesus questioning Pilate. The Roman Empire was awash with many claims to truth. And so as far as Pilate is concerned, the Jewish claim to truth was just another such claim. His dismissive question, "What is truth?" shows that he probably didn't think much of any truth claim. One to him was no better or worse than another, just different. Jesus' words preceding Pilate's question reveal to us what Jesus taught about truth. Now, recall Jesus said, "You say that I am a king for this purpose. I was born and for this purpose I have come into the world." And the purpose was to bear witness to the truth. "Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." I want us to notice particularly the phrase, "everyone who is of the truth." Notice that Jesus doesn't say, "everyone who knows the truth," or "everyone who possesses the truth," or "everyone who observes the truth." No, Jesus uses the phrase, "of the truth," because I believe to Jesus, ultimate truth is a living and a growing, a relational experience. It's not a static set of knowledge or facts or laws or even doctrines. Just as it was in the Roman Empire, much of the modern world rejects the concept of absolute or ultimate truth. The reality is that the rejection is more about the dismissal of absolute claims about knowledge and dismissal of faith and reliance upon knowledge and upon facts. Most dismiss absolute claims to truth do so simply because they don't believe it is possible to ever know everything absolutely perfectly. Rather, they believe that truth is something that is learned through experience, through relationships. And so, I believe we should rejoice that such a change is coming about. The philosophical worldview of today's people, at least in this key point, I believe is actually getting closer to God's view of truth. Now, I cringe whenever I hear someone say, "We have the truth." And that statement, from my perspective, is simply not biblical. None of us can ever have the truth. Rather, according to what Jesus said to Pilate, the truth possesses us. We can belong to the living truth? Or, as the Jewish leaders and Pilate eventually did, he can choose to stay away. When a person belongs to the truth, it frees them. But when a person thinks they own truth, I believe it leads to enslavement. Enslavement in legalism. Similarly, if a person rejects any possibility of truth, it too leads to a kind of slavery, a slavery to despair. And I believe both are depicted in today's story. Now, both legalism and despair, because those who are enslaved by them have, in some ways, lost control of themselves. In turn, they seek to enslave others to try to regain control and power. Both seek to control thoughts and behavior of others. And this is done through fear, through intimidation, force, coercion, and manipulations through promises of rewards or threats of punishment. God's truth has nothing to do with such things. God's truth has no room for fear or for intimidation or force or coercion or manipulation through either rewards or punishment. Now, if we want to distinguish between truth and deception, one test, I believe, would be to see if a claim or teaching underneath it or anywhere in it has any sort of manipulative motivations behind it. Because if it does, I would dare say that it isn't from God, rather, it's from the devil. When Pilate comes out and offers to free either Jesus or Barabbas, John depicts the choice that everyone is offered. Jesus is the divine son of the divine father. Barabbas is literally, as I mentioned earlier, son of the father. Well, perhaps an intentional allusion by John to the father of the world, the devil. Everyone, all of us, are given two versions of truth. Barabbas, representing truth, based on force and on violence. Or Jesus, representing truth based on selfless giving, non-coercive, non-violent love. In the choice that the Jewish leaders make, and in the acceptance of that choice by Pilate, all of humanity is complicit in choosing the way of force. We are all to blame for murdering God. The good news is that God allowed us to do that. He didn't override our freedom to choose, even to kill God. And the better and best news is that in spite of our past, if we want to come to the truth and become a part of Him, He welcomes us in. I think that Pilate's question, what is truth, is arguably the most important question to be asked. And how it is answered is absolutely critical because it can shape the entire philosophical and theological framework of a person. If truth is primarily defined as knowledge and facts, it can lead to rigidity and intolerance. But instead, if truth is defined primarily as an experiential walk, a relationship with God, I believe that it will lead to flexibility and tolerance, traits that I believe God is shown to have exhibited throughout history in all His dealings with people. A person may have correct fact, right knowledge, and sound reasoning, but without love, what is technically correct, I believe, is still deception, because it doesn't reveal the truth about God. hitting a little closer to home, every Christian doctrine, every Adventist doctrine, without love, is no better than a lie. Paul's exhortation on love in 1 Corinthians 13 is critical because it is the very basis of giving witness about Jesus and about God. I just want to go back to 1 Corinthians 13. I'm going to read. I'll read the whole chapter in Eugene Peterson's The Message translation. If I speak with human eloquence and angelic ecstasy, but don't love, I'm nothing but the creaking of a rusty gate. If I speak God's word with power, revealing all His mysteries and making everything plain as day, and if I have faith that says to a mountain, jump, and it jumps, but I don't love, I'm nothing. If I give everything I own to the poor and even go to the stake to be burned as a martyr, but I don't love, I've gotten nowhere. So no matter what I say, what I believe, and what I do, I'm bankrupt without love. Love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for self. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. Love doesn't strut, doesn't have a swelled head, doesn't force itself on others, isn't always me first, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel, takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always, always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. Love never dies. Inspired speech will be over someday. Praying in tongues will end. Understanding will reach its limit. We know only a portion of the truth, and what we say about God is always incomplete. But when the complete arrives, our incompleteness will be canceled. When I was an infant, at my mother's breast, I gurgled and cooed like an infant. When I grew up, I left those infant ways for good. We don't yet see things clearly. We're squinting in a fog, peering through a mist. But it won't be long before the weather clears and the sun shines bright. We'll see it all then. See it all as clearly as God sees us. Knowing Him directly just as He knows us. But for right now, until that completeness, we have three things to do to lead us toward that consummation. Trust steadily in God. Hope unswervingly. Love extravagantly. And the best of the three is love. In chapter 14, verse 1. Go after a life of love as if your life depended on it. Because it does. So today, this morning, I encourage each one of us to choose the way of love. Choose to belong to God.